All right, well, tonight is more of a topical sermon rather than exploring a specific passage. And last week we began talking about Sabbath. And in Chad's sermon, he talked about Sabbath. And when the topic of Sabbath comes up, one of the common questions that's asked, and I think it's a fair question, is, are Christians expected to observe the Sabbath today? Or was it something that's under the old covenant and it's no longer binding in the new covenant? And I think for us modern Americans, the idea of devoting a whole day or even part of a day to ceasing from work and giving ourselves to rest is just so foreign that we just think it can't, we just assume it can't possibly actually be commanded by God. It just doesn't fit into life as we know it. And we're constantly looking for ways to be more productive, not less. So we're not likely to look for a whole day of rest. When we look at the week, when we look at the way that we actually live a week, it's a Monday through Friday work and school week followed by a weekend, right? Is that how most of you live life? That's the lived experience that we have. Monday through Friday is work and school, and then there's the weekend after it. Now, your calendar will show Sunday as the first day of the week, but almost nobody actually lives with Sunday as the first day of the week. Instead, Sunday is usually just the last day of the weekend. It's the day to catch up on everything that has to be done for the coming Monday and the coming work and school week. It's kind of a catch-all day. Monday through Friday drive the week, and on the weekend, then we try to recover. That's our lived experience of the week, for at least for most of us. And I think the kind of the mental picture that I get of this is that our weeks become like boxes. Think of like a shoebox, a rectangular box. Our week becomes like boxes where you have Monday through Friday, and then you have the weekend at the end. And so a week begins on Monday, and we work toward the weekend. And when the weekend concludes, the week is over. When Sunday is over, the week is over. And we take that box, the week is over, and we put it on the shelf. And we get down a new box. Monday starts the new week. It's opening a new box. And we start over again. And then that week gets to the end of the weekend. And then we take that week and we put that box on the shelf. That's why for many of us, Mondays are so hard. It's such a hard start to the week because it's the beginning of a whole new week and the weekend is so far away. It's like trying to start an engine that's been just sitting out in the cold for days and days and days. It's such a hard start. And so if we look at the week this way in our lived experience of Monday through Friday and then a weekend, Sabbath just does not fit. It just doesn't fit the modern American lifestyle. There's just not enough room in the box to fit Sabbath in. So I think we just assume, because of that, that the commandment can't possibly be binding upon Christians. And it was just part of the old covenant, but in the new, it's not valid, and it's no different than not eating pork. And now we're allowed to eat pork, and we don't keep Sabbath. Okay? One challenge to this kind of thinking is that if you look at the other nine commandments and ask if they're still valid, okay? So work through the Decalogue and ask if those commandments are still valid. So have no other gods before God. Don't make a carved image and worship it. Don't take God's name in vain. Honor your father and mother. Don't murder, don't commit adultery, don't steal, don't bear false witness against your neighbor, don't covet anything that is your neighbor's. I don't think we can argue that in the new covenant any of those have been overturned and they're no longer valid. None of those are obsolete, which suggests that remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy is just as live as the other nine, right? But I think that's the wrong way to go about this. I think it's the wrong way to think about the command to keep the Sabbath. Because Jesus isn't concerned with just keeping the letter of the law. He's not concerned about keeping the commandments as much as he's concerned about keeping the heart of the commandments. The heart of the commandments. That's what Jesus is concerned about. So, for example, in Matthew 5, 21 to 22, this will sound familiar, I'm sure. Jesus says, "You have heard that it was said to those of old, 'You shall not murder, and whoever murders will be liable to judgment.' But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother will be liable to the council. And whoever says, you fool, will be liable to the hell of fire. So it wouldn't do to go up to Jesus and say, Jesus, I didn't murder anybody today. Aren't you proud of me? That wouldn't work. I think we would all agree that not murdering is a low expectation for one another, right? That's putting the bar on the ground and tripping over it if you murder somebody. But Jesus asks, yes, but have you murdered your brother in your heart? Have you had murderous thoughts toward your brother in your heart? Have you hated your brother in your heart? Have you been like Cain to your brother in your heart? I saw a t-shirt that read, I may look calm, but in my head I've punched you in the face 3 times. And Jesus, he takes the letter of the commandment and he backs it up to the heart level. That's what he does. He takes the commandment and he backs it up to the heart level. And he does the same thing with the commandment to not commit adultery. He says, not actually committing adultery is not the point. That's not the point. Because you can commit adultery in your heart. And that's just as much a reflection of sin corroding your heart as an actual affair. And Paul does this in Ephesians 4:28 with the commandment to not steal. Paul says, let the thief no longer steal, but rather let him labor, doing honest work with his own hands, so that he may have something to share with anyone in need. So for someone inclined to steal from others, not stealing is outward compliance with the law, but to fulfill the law is to do labor with that person's hands so that they can give and they can share with others. So it's not just don't steal, but actually use your hands for good so that you can do work and you can share with others. So what I want to do tonight is explore the heart of the fourth commandment. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. What is in the heart of the commandment that is still valid and binding for us as Christians? Does that make sense? What's in the heart of the commandment for us? So I'll read Exodus 20, 8 through 11 again that Brian read earlier. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, your male servant or your female servant or your livestock or the sojourner who is within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. So Sabbath comes from the Hebrew word Shabbat, which means to cease. That's what Sabbath means. It means to cease. The Israelites were to work 6 days, and then they were to cease from their work on the Sabbath. Now think about this. In transforming a nation from slavery to being a people that would trust God, God imposed a calendar upon Israel. That was part of God's plan to transform a nation from a mentality of slavery to one that would trust him. He imposed a calendar upon them. And with that calendar came limitations. There were limits in the calendar. There were whole weeks where they weren't supposed to do anything. And there was the weekly Sabbath. They could not work every day. Now, for a former nation of slaves, the thought of a day off, a thought of a day devoted completely to rest, would have been like heaven. I don't think so. I don't think so. I don't think that the Israelites would have necessarily looked at it that way. In fact, I think that they would have thought that it was very difficult. So consider this. If taking a weekly day to cease from labor and to devote oneself to rest was so easy, why did God impose the death penalty for those who broke the Sabbath? Why would God impose the death penalty for something that people would want to do? If you're telling me I got to hold a couch down for 2 days or die, I'm going to hold a couch down. I can do that pretty well. Dawn might get mad at me, but I'm going to do it to save my life. In Exodus 31, twice, and in Exodus 35, God says, 6 days shall work be done, but the seventh day is a Sabbath of solemn rest, holy to the Lord. Whoever does any work on the Sabbath day shall be put to death. And in Numbers 15, a Sabbath breaker is executed. A man's out gathering sticks on the Sabbath, and he's executed. This suggests, I think, that resting, that ceasing from our labors and resting is not natural for us. We don't like limits. We don't like limits imposed upon us. And so this is not natural for us. God had to command it and follow it up with a strict punishment because we resist having limits. We push against limits if we can, and we chafe against limits that we can't do anything about. For Israel and for us, there's always something that feels like it needs to be done. There's always something that feels like it needs to be done. The task list is almost never fully checked off. And we feel inadequate and we feel threatened when we can't actually work toward what we want fulfilled, what we want to see done, especially when our goal is gathering the resources that we need to live. If we feel like our lives are threatened because we can't work, then we're going to chafe against that. We're going to push against that. And we're going to want to work. Moses commanded the Israelites not to keep their manna overnight. But you know what? Some did. And it turned rotten and it stank. But they did it because they thought, well, what if there's no manna tomorrow? What if we wake up and we go out and there's no manna? I'm holding on to this. I'm not trusting my survival to anybody else. I'm not leaving that to chance. Moses commanded the Israelites not to gather manna on the Sabbath. Instead, they were to gather twice as much the day before and not gather on the Sabbath. But you know what? Some of them did. Some of them went out on the Sabbath and they started gathering because they thought, well, maybe there's not going to be enough. Maybe I can get ahead. Nobody else is out here. And maybe I can get more. I'm not leaving my survival to chance. Point is, the Israelites didn't trust God. Those Israelites didn't trust God. And so they kept striving to secure for themselves. They kept striving to secure their lives, and they couldn't enter into the rest of trusting God. If they could have just kept the commandment, that would have been an important first step toward being able to learn to trust God, because they would have kept the commandment, and God would have taken care of them. But for many of them, they just couldn't do it until God made a law that if you break the Sabbath, you will be executed. He had to threaten their lives in order to get them to rest. This is how much we resist limits. This is how foreign I think this is to us. So the main thing that I want to say tonight is that the heart of Sabbath keeping is joyfully receiving the gift of limits. It's joyfully receiving the gift of limits. That's the heart of the Sabbath. Now, the Bible praises being industrious. Proverbs, it's all about working hard. Study the ant. Be like the ant. Go out, work hard. Use wisdom to increase the gain of your work. But against that backdrop, for a set day each week, for us it might just be a set time. It may not be a whole day. It may be, it may not. But for a set time every week, we are to joyfully receive an imposed limit, where we limit ourselves and we limit our striving. We cease from activity that advances our agenda, our goals, our prosperity, our projects, our sense of security. We let all of those things sit undone for a time. And I think a lot of the genius of Sabbath is looking at those things being undone and being content that they're undone. But we let those things sit undone for a time, and we ground ourselves in the reality that we are perfectly loved, we are perfectly cared for, and we are perfectly provided for by our Father in the heavens. Does that make sense? We let those things sit, and we rest in God, and we rest in His provision and His care. We don't like limits. We don't like limits of time. We don't like limits of resources. We don't like our own limits, our own limitations. And so we strive to transcend those. We strive to beat those. And that's not always bad. Sometimes it's good to push ourselves past limits that we think we can get past. But the world can only give us tips and tricks. God gives us the Sabbath. God invites us into rest. God commands us out of the hamster wheel of our own anxieties and says, just sit down and rest in me. Let me take care of you. Let me prove to you again that I will take care of you, that I am your good shepherd. And he reminds us that we have enough because we have him. Now, next week, I'm going to dig into a little bit more of the practical guidance of Sabbath keeping, some actual thoughts about not tips and tricks, but some practical guidance for things, ways that we can keep Sabbath. But it's no good talking about practices until we know what we're actually ceasing from. Until we realize that what we need to cease from is our own anxiety, our own desire to get ahead, our own desire to secure our lives. And I think this is a good place to revisit the two accounts from Mark that Brian read earlier, where Jesus and his disciples are accused of breaking the Sabbath. So Jesus lets his disciples pick the heads of grain while they're in the grain field. And then later, Jesus heals a man with a withered hand in the synagogue. What is he doing? What's the point of these stories? Because the disciples weren't going to starve, for one. They could have fasted the rest of the day. They weren't going to starve while they were out. They could have fasted. They could have been content to go without. The man with the withered hand could have been healed the next day, really. And a withered hand is not a life and death matter. The man wasn't going to die. If Jesus' purpose is to show exceptions to the Sabbath, these aren't even very good exceptions. Because it wasn't a life or death situation and they weren't going to starve. So what's going on? There's something deeper going on. Jesus says the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. The Sabbath was not imposed by God so that man would have another rule to keep. That wasn't the reason for it. The Sabbath was given so that man would cease from his normal mode of striving and rest in God's care and provision. And plucking grain along the way doesn't take away from that. That's not personal striving. It wasn't going to take away from the intention of the Sabbath. Healing somebody, doing good for another person, doesn't interfere with the heart of Sabbath. It's not striving to get yourself ahead, securing for yourself. It's helping another person. And so if somebody is moving on a Sunday, you can help them move. You can't say, well, it's work. I don't work on the Sabbath. You can help somebody move on the Sabbath because it's ceasing from your own striving and pouring out your life for somebody else. You know who needed to cease their labors in these gospel accounts? It's the Pharisees. The Pharisees are the ones who needed to cease from their labor. I always imagine the Pharisees hiding in the grain field and then popping out. Ha ha! We got you. You're harvesting by plucking the grain, you Sabbath breakers. You know, Jesus reminds them of David eating the bread of presence, the bread of the presence in the house of God. Now, why does he do that? Is it to justify the disciples eating the heads of grain? No. He doesn't tell them a story to justify that. Because do you remember what happens after David and his companions eat the bread of the presence in the synagogue? After that, a man named Doeg the Edomite goes to Saul and says, Saul, David and his men were at the house of God, and Ahimelech served him. And Saul comes and has all 85 of the priests executed and puts the entire city to the sword. Man, woman, elderly, infant, ox, sheep, donkey, everything. Treats it like a Canaanite city and puts the whole thing to the sword. Saul was so threatened by David that he wiped out an entire city that he suspected was loyal to David, not to him. So keep that in mind. Later in the synagogue, which I think happened the same day as the grain incident, Jesus asks the Pharisees, is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do harm, to save life or to kill? Now, that David story had to be ringing in their ears because he just told it. Had to be ringing in their ears. They had to have known that Jesus was linking the Pharisees to Saul and Doeg the Edomite. And they could have cried out, we don't want to have the heart of Saul. We don't want to have a heart that strives to secure for ourselves so that nobody will take our little kingdom away. But instead, Mark says, they were silent. They were silent. And Jesus looked around at them with anger, grieved at their hardness of heart. Jesus heals the man with the withered hand, and we're told the Pharisees went out and immediately held counsel with the Herodians against him, how to destroy him. You know what the irony is? They're working on the Sabbath. The Pharisees are working on the Sabbath, trying to find out a way to destroy Jesus. Because they're striving to secure their little kingdoms, and they don't want to yield to his. And I think Jesus' question to them is, how can you understand the Sabbath if you have the heart of Saul? How can you understand the Sabbath if you have a hard heart? Now, I'm not saying that if you don't observe the Sabbath that you'll become a murderer like Saul or the Pharisees. I'm not saying that. But the drive to secure for ourselves is very strong. It's very strong. And a lot of times we can take pride in it. And we run the risk of always thinking that we need a little bit more. Need a little bit more. There might not be enough. Need to get a little bit more. Need to get ahead. The Sabbath was made for man to cease from all that. For a time, every week, some kind of time, to cease from that. That was meant for man, for his good and for the good of all around him, to rest securely in God's provision and his goodness. Is that good? I want to close with this thought, and I'll probably revisit it next week. I want you to imagine that you're one of the faithful Israelites after God has brought you across the Red Sea, after Sinai. Okay, you're one of the faithful Israelites. And you're observing Sabbath, maybe for the first time. What do you do? One thing that I think you do, and one thing that I think you can only do if you're at rest, if you're still, if you're paying attention, is to take in the new reality. If you're an Israelite observing Sabbath and you're at rest, you can take in your new reality. You've been rescued by God from a murderous tyrant. This God has claimed you as his own, and you belong to his people. His laws will regulate your life and the life of the community toward health and peace and love. And he's taking you to a good, abundant land where you will live with your God. And you can take that in. Wow. And you just think about that and marvel at it. And then you talk with others about it, who are also in a place of rest and contentment and stillness and overflowing with gratitude to the God who's done this. When we cease from our labors, we're in a position to take in our new reality as well. We've been rescued by God from the devil and from our own sin and folly. Jesus claims us as his own, and we belong to his people. Jesus' way of life, empowered by the Spirit, gives us life to the full. And God's Spirit is transforming us into the likeness of his Son, and we will dwell in the presence of God forever. And we didn't do any of it. We didn't do any of it. That's nothing that we accomplished by our striving, by our ceaseless labors. It was done for us. God's brought us into his family by his power, by his goodness, by his grace. So we can cease from our labors. We can do that. And we can rest in God's perfect love and care and provision. Amen? Amen. One thing that we've done in the past and